I mean, two things that pop into my mind are going to be this 85 percentile versus the 95th percentile, and then also what is an approved project? How do you define that to make this, you know, easy?
And
timing of institution. Yeah, okay. Those are the three big items. But then anything else that you heard that needs to be, you know, should be addressed or clarified?
I'd like to throw more thing in there, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
And I don't know if this notice was sent out strictly from Paso Robles South, or was it to all the cities? Because I don't see any representation from Monterey Peninsula or Salinas or Santa Cruz or San Benito County, all those entities. I'm sure they would have some of the same concerns and some of the same questions, but I surely would like, there is somebody from somewhere
Salinas.
Up north.
Salinas.
Yeah. Salinas, okay. There is a Salinas man here. But it's still, I have problems that, you know, of course, San Luis Obispo, this is our main office, and it's easy for everybody to come to San Luis Obispo other than the northern people. But I really like to hear from those folks. Not that I'd like to have another meeting, but I would like to have some consideration of maybe continuing this item to have it a meeting in the north that we can hear from those folks as well. I'll just throw that in the mix.
Who's the gentleman from Salinas?
It's Walter Grant.
Is he from the city of Salinas?
Yes.
Oh,
yeah,
he's available then to.
Well, he's only one city. We got, you know.
Well, we did get comments from.
And
folks.
Hang on, Dominic. Where are you guys from?
Monterey County.
Pebble Beach.
Okay. All right. Go ahead, Dominic.
Yeah, we've received comments from both non-municipal interested parties, Michael Waxer. We've received a comment from Michael Wadsworth. Those are both architects. Harvey Oslick actually assisted us with developing the sizing criteria. He's a practicing engineer for RBF Consulting. Monterey Regional Stormwater Program submitted comments. City of Santa Cruz, City of Watsonville, University of California. I apologize. Santa Cruz didn't, but Santa Barbara did. County of Santa Cruz, County of Santa Clara, City of Salinas, City of Pacific Grove, City of Carmel by the Sea. Those are all submitted comments that we've responded to. And so I feel like their interests are definitely have been voiced. And we have also presented our workshops for the joint effort in two locations to address the issue of geographic disadvantage, as you were describing. We've had them in Santa Maria for folks in the south part of the region, and we've had them in Watsonville for areas in the north. So, and of course, the notice was widely distributed. So, okay. Well, I think the three issues you've identified, Mr. Young, are correspond well with the discussion we had over lunch. To see if we could address those issues in a manner that was satisfactory to everyone.
Hold on one sec. Mr. Johnston?
If we're making a little checklist of issues, I had some too, and I can do that after. Maybe we should finish doing that before we have Dominic.
I just threw out
the top three
in my mind, but I asked him to go through everything. How many more do you have on your list? Five? Why don't you give them to him, and hopefully he's...
Some of them are maybe relatively minor. This is just kind of the checklist
Go
I
ahead.
Made while I was
Go
looking
ahead.
At the comments. And yours were the 95%, the what's in the pipeline, and the timeline. Is that correct?
Some
of these were quite specific, but there was the question of the infiltration barrier, horizontal infiltration barrier. There was the question of the very specific language change proposed by the City of Santa Barbara. There was the question of retention being based on amount of stormwater that falls rather than on the natural condition ability of the site to absorb rainwater, rainfall, undeveloped site based on soil conditions. And there were two questions regarding the urban sustainability area. One was regarding how that related to alternative compliance and feeling that that really wasn't a workable prospect in the timelines given. And the other was wanting some specificity that urban reserve areas in unincorporated urban reserve areas would be eligible for consideration as urban sustainability areas. So that was kind of my big checklist.
Okay, Dr. Wolf.
Okay, I had some micro questions and observation and then a couple of little housekeeping items. In the big picture, I think for one thing, we should not overlook that there's going to be a positive impact to municipalities with this regulation by improving the stormwater discharge into municipalities by having this post-construction program. Now, there hasn't been a quantitative analysis here, at least to my knowledge, of saying, okay, we're estimating that this will reduce the pressure on municipalities' stormwater system by X amount, because obviously that's going to be predicated on the amount of new construction. But I think in the big picture, we need to also look at the positive impact to municipalities. And so I would suggest from there that although obviously there's going to be some added cost to municipalities to administer this program, there is an offset benefit, albeit I can't, you know, I don't, it's not quite measurable.
And before we get to that, because that's like the next discussion after we hear back from them, do you have any points that you want to make sure they cover?
Right. The points are, one of them I discussed earlier is the financial infeasibility. I think that's not an objective way of looking at weighting whether or not a project would be acceptable. The timeline of 6 months I don't think is reasonable. You know, one of my colleagues mentioned his experience as mayor. Me, I'm on some other San Luis Obispo County advisory group, and I can see how long it takes to implement things. So I think that's an issue. The other one is harmonization with state standards. So if 85% versus 95, I think we need to try to harmonize what we're doing here with what the state does. That way we don't end up having to revisit things. Then in terms of housekeeping, and my pages are slightly out of order because I have not been able to keep track of yellows versus whites. So I'll give you the section. And this pertains in the old white. Page 5, we have a requirement that lists in great details requirements of a mixture of sand 60-70% meeting specification of ESTM and a compost of 30-40%. We're going a lot of detail, and I know we try to put specificity in these standards, but I don't think we want to inadvertently micromanage each site. And I would submit to you that in some cases a gypsum amendment can be actually a lot better than using a sand mix with compost in terms of improving pH and permeability. So I don't think we should get to that level of detail of telling you know, the community exactly what kind of soil mix they need to put in their backyard. Then when we look at the storm water control plan requirements, which is item C, we're talking about the permittee need to list the application, the project, the type of soils, etc. And I'm wondering who is going to be the responsible party? Is it a contractor? Because you do have a lot of homeowner-built projects. And so how we're going to recognize who has the authority of providing this report? Does it have to be a licensed landscape architect or a civil engineer? Or that's going to be up to the discretion of a municipality to decide who is going to be the, you know, authorized, recognized party. Then, let's see, I'm almost done here, so I'm going to make this painless. Then on page 12, white page, item 6, performance requirement number 5, special circumstances. We list under special circumstance San Lorenzo River, City of Santa Cruz, and then we're saying project runoff discharge to other areas identified by the Central Coast Water Board. And I think we need to open that up a little bit more by having some language that says, or submitted for special circumstance consideration by permittee. So, you know, obviously there's been some cities who have, you know, made an effort to communicate with the staff to be listed into this exemption. But maybe not all cities have had the opportunity to do that. So by leaving it a little more open, rather than having the Central Coast Water Board making the identification, that we would also encourage permittees to, you know, introduce for consideration exemption, if that makes sense.
We'll have them, they'll address it.
Well, I just want to make sure my English is clear. Okay.
Once
in a while, my English is a little challenged, so I
understand it just fine.
All right. So, and then lastly, you know, I read the entire document, and I've felt that, you know, you folks did a good job trying to integrate all the various requirements into these documents. So, thank you,
Mr. Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The only other item, other than some that I've already chatted about and that you've heard, I heard several speakers talk less than enthusiastically about alternative compliance. And frankly, I'm just pretty hazy on that section too, trying to read through it and figure out what it actually means in real examples on the ground. And maybe if you could just at some point later walk through that in a layman's manner, and especially addressing some of the timelines that are involved with, you do your project, but you have a certain amount of time going forward to work on your alternative one, and what the fallout is, or what the, if something falls out in that, what the recourse is, and that kind of thing. Thanks.
All right. I hope everyone has a little while. Apologies to my colleagues from my fellow citizens from Los Osos. We do appreciate the detailed comments that we got on the podium there, and it's quite gratifying to see that the board has identified the very same issues we wanted to address. So I'll start with the top three. I think it might be best to just start with the timeline for implementation right off the bat, and point out that we have made significant sort of delays in getting to this point, but the case that the municipalities are making that these requirements are in fact fairly complicated and do need time to digest, and that the process for approving ordinances is constrained by a lot of different issues is one that we concur with, and we are prepared to suggest to the board an alternative date of implementation that would extend it from 6 months to a full year. So we'd be making some changes to the language in the document. Kind of dark in here, but let's see if I got a clicker with a pointer. Let's see. Yeah, so right here, this map is already, or rather this document has already, it's from the first supplemental sheet. It represents the most current version of the track changes version of the resolution and the attachments.
Is this 1A?
So this is 1A.
Attachment 1A, okay.
I believe, well, it's actually, go to your supplemental sheet number one. It's in a yellow.
It's the yellow supplemental sheet. Yeah, and after it's on, it begins on the third page of the document is attachment one, and this is what he's referencing. So from now on, the top of the page should have the page number, and it should correspond to the page numbers in attachment one.
So yeah, this this appears on page two at the bottom. So it's section B, 1E. And from this point forward, we will be referring to that copy in your hand for any changes we make. So that supplemental sheet included these changes that just, this was a point of clarification in the language, the blue text you see. But the change we're now proposing is in red, and it goes from 180 to 365 days. So that addresses a lot of the issues that folks were having about the time frame for adopting ordinances, developing guidance, and implementing these requirements.
Sorry, I just want to make a clarification.
Okay.
In the yellow sheet, the blue sentence that says within 180 days, somehow that was, it's not on here.
No.
It is. So that blank space, follow along.
Because it's yellow, is that why? Or because it's
different? Looks like.
Yeah, it could be.
That's what it is. It disappears in yellow.
All I have is private development projects.
So just in case there, I wanted to clarify for the board members.
Thank you. You are looking at, on the screen, the document in yellow, but unfortunately it doesn't copy, which is kind of curious.
I don't have that.
I don't think that's ever been a help.
We have lots of missing.
It's missing.
Yeah, it's on. It's missing.
Okay.
It's not. Is any of the changes shown? Are any of the other changes shown? I mean, they're all invisible.
I actually have. I have them on white.
There's a lot.
They all show up.
Dominic, just considering, let's move ahead, considering the time limitations,
okay.
And we'll make sure that when we do this in the future that we either use like double underline, and if colors become a problem, we'll double check that.
Yeah, this is a new one on this.
So. Yeah, so let's continue.
Dominic?
Yes.
I am looking at the online version and looking
white.
At my hard copy, and yes, there's text missing throughout. So if whatever you present to us, if you could just read it out loud so that we understand it, that would be helpful. Thank you.
The online version is visible as well?
I can read it.
Okay. You can read it. Okay. All right. So there's the first issue of the implementation deadline. This issue relates completely to the projects in the pipeline, the projects that have received some level of existing approval but may be subject to subsequent requirements because they haven't receive their final discretionary approval. So we've revised that section as well. And this there's no changes that you need to refer to in the yellow sheet. This is all new text here, or new strikeout. And where it once said had a fairly complicated explanation of we're trying to capture projects that have been approved on some level but not entirely, we've now eliminated all of that text and replaced it with the following sentence: the permittee shall apply the post-construction requirements to those projects that have not received their first discretionary approval for project design. Again, this would not, if you have not received a project approval in the next year, you would be subject to these requirements. But that project approval, or rather that discretionary approval, refers to project design phases. The problem we're trying to address is that big development projects come in a variety of different phases, as you're aware. The first approval may be a zoning change. It might be a map subdivision that simply reallocates property lines or rededicates a zoning from mixed use to residential or something, or usually vice versa. Those kinds of approvals could occur at a stage where no real effort has been made to do design and no thought, really effort has been placed into the stormwater management aspect of the project. So in our opinion, if you have one of those approvals, you should still be subject to these requirements because you haven't even initiated your design phase. But if the approval is for a design phase, if it is a discretionary approval of the location of the footprints of the buildings, if it's a discretionary approval that allocates an open space easement relative to the built portion of the site, those are decisions that may have involved a decision about the cost and the approach to managing stormwater. We don't mean to penalize those or affect those. So with this wording change, we're trying to address projects at the right phase where they haven't made any significant investment in their drainage design or stormwater management approach. We're using the term approval of project design, recognizing that there's a common sense understanding of that term. It is not a technical term, and people may choose to make fairly kind of obscure interpretations of that, but we're trusting that the municipalities will be basically the watchdogs of that and ensure that no one fully abuses that terminology. Anybody on the board, yeah, who'd like to comment on that? Appreciate that.
I just have a question. I mean, so it seems like what we're saying is in these proposed or what staff's recommending in these proposed changes is a year, if we were to approve something today, then anybody who hasn't had a discretionary approval of project design by a year from now is subject to these, and anybody who has is not. Is that correct?
Correct.
I guess my question is, discretionary approval of project design. So my question is, would we expect this to generate a flood of requests for permits for things that might or might not ever be built between now and 365 days from now?
It's possible. If you can imagine if we had said projects that were deemed complete, you can guarantee there would have been a lot of paper applications submitted in order to get a deemed complete application, which would really be a flood, I would suggest. I think project design really does, it's taken seriously by the consulting development community. I don't think they're going to be rushing a bunch of designs that aren't smart and thought out, but that, I guess, is a possibility. It gives them a full year to contemplate those designs.
Okay. Thank you for explaining the complexity of that for me a little bit.
Mr. Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand where you're trying to go, and now you've kind of gone way past where I'm comfortable with too. So, and I don't have any answer for you, but your example just bridged my problem in that I think you actually gave an example of, well, if you're just doing a discretionary approval and it's just setting up a subdivision, we still want to catch you on the design end. But I think you gave an example there where you're talking about building footprints or envelopes, what I'd be more familiar with. And I see frequently that subdivision acts going through planning commission approval for a discretionary approval will frequently set out the streets, set out the drainage, and set out a building envelope. And then no other design. Might even have a grading plan, but no other design. And that might be the initial discretionary approval, and then it's off to a year or two of design haggling with the various design boards. And so I don't have an answer for you, but I just see the problem in the description there, and if you're comfortable with throwing that word design in there and defending that back to the municipalities, then I'm comfortable with it too. So I just want to point that out.
I appreciate that, and we're quite aware of that risk. I think this is a good example of a no-size-fits-all approach. We have worked on this language off and on for a couple of years. Every other permit has had to do the same thing. They've gone between deemed complete, vested map approval, a variety. And in this room, we heard several versions of what's the right phase in which to apply that. So we are not going to resolve that to everyone's satisfaction. I think everyone's going to have a little bit of discomfort with the final suggested language, but I would point out that Water Board staff has comfortable with this, could accept this language. We also want to point out that we've preserved the exemption language, which appears down below, which still provides for the opportunity for someone to demonstrate that, look, I laid out this site with the understanding that I could use this much imperviousness. It's been approved. Having to address these concerns will cause me harm. I want to also point out that these requirements are not going to be that burdensome. We have placed 10% caps on the amount of actual dedicated site. I mean, the frequency which with these requirements are going to cause significant financial redesign impacts to a project, I think is incredibly small. I think people are reacting to the potential and imagining a bigger set of revisions than what they're thinking. I think that gets back to a couple other issues on the list here, but we now have an extension of the time frame to 1 year that also benefits projects that are in the pipeline, and we've also addressed the actual phase of approval that we expect to apply these to. So those are the first two issues. The third issue, forgot whether 95. It was the 95th, okay. The first issue is people have brought up the question of whether the 95th percentile storm event is an appropriate standard, since it appears to be used by no one else but the federal government that they're aware of. And it is not consistent with the Phase 2 permit, for example, or with some of the other approaches around the country or the state. The first thing I want to point out is that this discussion seemed to be predicated on the concept that everyone is going to have to meet the 95th percentile stormwater retention volume, and that's not the case. We have provided significant adjustments within the regulations and requirements that allow people to actually simply retain the 85th percentile and release. They need to design with the possibility of infiltrating more, but if the site cannot infiltrate that amount, the release is allowed through under drains and overflow facilities. So we need to get clear that the actual requirement, while stated, is achieve 95th percentile stormwater retention. The actual implementation and compliance approach does not result in retaining that amount of volume unless the site is actually an A or B soil that actually can accommodate that amount of infiltration. So that's really critical, because all of the comments about the feasibility of that are predicated on the assumption that we're holding people to the full retention value, and we're not. That's the first thing.
But don't they have to then retain that elsewhere?
No. There's a 10% cap on the amount of site that must be dedicated to retention facilities, and if they have met the 10%, they're not required to meet that off-site requirement.
Okay.
Dominic, have you changed the language that
no,
refers
No, people to just aren't reading it carefully and understanding it, and I'm prepared to provide a lot of explanation of that as time goes on, but that is really a hard thing for people to understand. Because as we made these revisions, we did not revise the structure of the document. I think people are seeing the requirements in one place, and they're not reading to the end to recognize that they have this out in the 10%, for example. It's hard to put it all together and make that conclusion, but that is the requirement.
To cover everybody's, but I think maybe we need to put a little clearer language or put a footnote in there that expands upon it so there isn't any misunderstanding of what the intent really is.
Well,
read that, I didn't really understand it either, because I was thinking it was 95.
The performance requirements stated is 95th percentile, and then all the compliance mechanisms are provided in the language. So the language doesn't need to be revised in order to provide people the possibility of not achieving 95th percentile. It's also important to mention that we're only talking about sites that are 15,000 square feet or larger. It's not all sites. And we're only talking about sites that are within certain watershed management zones, which really gets at the whole purpose of the 95th percentile stormwater event, which I'd like to describe for you.
Dominic, could I jump in here? Mr. Jeffries, Dominic, it was my understanding that as you went through this process over the past couple of years and the past several months, that you did revise the language to address this issue. So I think Mr. Jeffries was saying, we revised the language, and I think you did, and you made the 10% a cap. And I think that was in response to the municipality saying that there should be a limit
right
here. If it's 10%, then that should be the limit.
Right.
I think you did revise the language to accommodate that.
Right. And even within the 10%, the site conditions are going to dictate whether or not you can infiltrate. And so we've included hydrologic analysis and sizing guidance for an event-based approach that ensures that where infiltration doesn't occur, you can release that water. So
Dominic,
the site ultimately is dictating the infiltration.
If it wouldn't take too much time, can you just show the language on the board? I think that might be easier than...
The problem is there's like five places where we provide this kind of relief. If you want to see...
Can you show one example?
Okay, we could show the...
Most clear.
Mr. Chair, Figure 1C, requirement for large development projects, 15,000 square feet, new and replace impervious areas. You have a flow chart?
Yeah.
If you show that flow chart with your laser pointer, maybe you can kind of walk it through. It does not show that 10%,
it does
at
not.
Least it's
right.
A good start.
Right. Those flow charts are more kind of global. They do not get into the detail of the specific exemptions.
For everyone's edification, that flow chart that he's referencing is the last page of the yellow handout, the yellow supplemental sheet.
Which supplemental sheet?
The second supplemental sheet.
September 6th.
The September 6th prepared on August 29th, yep. Yes.
Okay.
Right here. Here's an example of I'm sorry. You guys got into the flow chart, and I've moved on to another. Are you looking at the flow chart still, or do you want to?
What page are you on right now?
Right now we're on page 9 of the yellow attachment. It describes the off-site mitigation requirement. So it's an example where it says off-site mitigation on the screen might be the best place to see this. Off-site mitigation of the full retention volume is not required where technically infeasible. And you've dedicated 10% of the project's impervious surface area to retention-based stormwater control measures. So if you've dedicated this amount of area, which is roughly equivalent to many of the landscaping requirements that are already in place in most municipalities, and dedicate it to these types of facilities, any additional retention that's not attained is you're off the hook. There's no off-site requirement for it. This substantially reduces the amount of off-site requirements. It substantially reduces the cost for any individual site to comply with these regulations. It's based on the site conditions, not on a random or, you know, theoretical stormwater volume. And so it's a direct concession to the technical infeasibility issues that have been raised. It's just one example. The other primary example is in the sizing guidance we provided, which ensures that while you might start the design with 95 percentile volumes in mind, you're not required to retain them all if your site does not allow for it. You're only required to retain what can be retained based on the infiltration capacity of that soil. The rest is allowed to be detained for 48 hours to ensure that we get water quality treatment through detention, extended detention. And the remainder flows from the site in an underdrain. This is incredibly accommodating and totally addresses the issue of site conditions dictating what's possible. And a lot of people brought this up, and I think you're right, Mr. Jeffries, that it's not quite sinking in, but these are the requirements. They do not expect people to achieve the entire retention volume. I was mentioning that the 95th percentile requirement does not apply everywhere. It only applies in the watershed management zones where our research and landscape stratification analysis actually indicated that infiltration was a predominant key watershed process where alluvial, recent quaternary sediments, and low slopes dictate that infiltration is going to occur where no disturbance has occurred. So in our basic, you know, the whole premise of the phase of the joint effort was to develop a approach to developing numeric criteria that was appropriate to the landscape. And that's why we developed a set of watershed management zones, is so that we don't apply the same requirement to every single location. We only apply it in the places where it is actually the appropriate watershed process to address. The thing about the 85th percentile, which people are familiar with and have been suggesting we move to, is that the 85th percentile storm event and the requirements associated with that have evolved to address water quality treatment, not water quality watershed processes. They evolved back in the late 20th century and have been adopted by water boards and approved in subsequent, you know, water board decisions. But what they amount to is that is that capturing and treating the 85th percentile storm event equates to accomplishing approximately 80% treatment or 80% reduction of pollutants in 80% of the annual stormwater volume. It is a water quality objective around which the 85th percentile evolved. It does not address watershed processes that speak to infiltration, recharge, the delivery of sediment and organic matter. And so what, to back out of that sort of technical issue, I want to make the case, or I want to impress upon you that the selection of the 95th percentile does not, A, harm people because they're required to meet an unreasonable requirement, B, is based on science and what the landscape is actually capable of doing, and C, should not be related to the 85th percentile, which has really been developed to address water quality, not watershed processes. So we are not prepared to adjust or recommend adjusting that. We don't believe that we are achieving water quality protection to the maximum extent practical in those areas where the landscape allowed for that amount of infiltration and where we should be making that the goal of our objectives, of our requirements. Regarding the phase two permit use of the 85th percentile, again, the phase two permit picks up the 85th percentile because it's been used in water quality treatment. But if you'll read the permit, the draft permit as it's on the street, you'll find that the permit clearly addresses the need to move beyond a water quality-based approach and move into a watershed process-based approach. And when the rest of the state conducts the landscape analysis that we have conducted here in the Central Coast, they will probably recognize that there's a need for them to also address the percentile rain events that they're requiring be addressed through stormwater management. So it is our view and our expectation that the Phase 2 permit will actually result in comparable watershed process-based requirements when it is adopted and when those communities begin to pursue development and compliance with that permit.
Thank you.
The issue of I'll take one that's fairly straightforward just to address one. Barry from, what's Barry's last name?
Rant.
From Morro Bay, identified the language pertaining to lateral infiltration or lateral liners into the facility.
Horizontal infiltration versus vertical.
Right. So we've actually agreed that we can make that adjustment, and I think it's page 11?
Is that what?
It's up? Oh, yeah. So I just wanted to show you how we've changed that language. We've simply added the phrase, except for situations where lateral infiltration is not technically feasible. So in that situation, they could use a liner.
Can you call out the pages? It's hard to read those.
Page 5?
Thank you.
Sorry. So that's one that was fairly straightforward to address. I want to also go ahead and address the issue that the City of Santa Barbara has raised about making the two-word change that they included in their the sheet they handed out. We're prepared to accept that change.
Okay. That's the one to pre-existing programs.
So it says if.
So you've made the changes?
Yes.
Okay.
I think the next big issue to address is alternative compliance. The first thing I want you to understand about alternative compliance is it's sort of a necessity. All post-construction requirements include some provision for alternative compliance. We have heard a lot of testimony today about the challenges that municipalities face in developing these approaches. I think most of the municipalities were conceiving of and speaking from the point of view of developing a broad programmatic approach to alternative compliance. And I want to first point out that these requirements do not require a city to do that, to develop a programmatic approach. In fact, alternative compliance is not required by these requirements at all. It probably is a necessity for certain situations. But the majority of situations that we expect the cities to confront with off-site compliance, now that we've adjusted these requirements to significantly reduce the amount of off-site compliance needed, the majority of the cases where we see the cities meeting this or addressing this isn't case-by-case or site-by-site, project-by-project alternative compliance or off-site compliance programs. So a lot of the issues surrounding the challenges of setting up the program, developing the Nexus study, and having to predict where the projects are, finding available land to do all the projects, being able to actually anticipate projects ahead of time and then select the sites for future alternative compliance, those kind of fall away if cities recognize they don't have to do that, if they can actually address this on a case-by-case basis. An individual site can be mitigated with an off-site compliance project within the right-of-way of a city's the city's right-of-way. But I think more importantly, off-site alternative or off-site compliance is not going to be very frequently required now that we've adjusted these requirements. We've just made an enormous adjustment by placing a 10% cap on the amount of a site that can be that must be dedicated to retention requirements. So we aren't proposing any adjustments. We've already made considerable adjustments to the language that address some of the specific issues about the amount of time you need to develop financing for off-site compliance if you choose to do an off-site project, about the amount of time that you'd be granted if you request it, if you're confronting challenges in finding, locating off-site projects. So we've actually made considerable adjustments to what was already in the language to make off-site compliance more feasible where a municipality chooses to pursue it. But there is no requirement that they pursue it in a programmatic fashion. So that should be clear to everyone. And I think the way it was being addressed suggested there's sort of this broad need and a need to develop that very soon in order to accommodate all these projects that are coming up. And I think that's not a realistic characterization of what cities will actually confront in the realm of off-site compliance. Related to off-site compliance, actually, Mr. Jordan, I don't know if that is addressing some of your issues. No?
So, given all that, mm-hmm. if I need to do it, I'm still hazy on what that means I need to do. I'm really, instead of trading a development right somewhere else, I'm really trading a development liability to another site, right? In a sense. I have to go do something somewhere else.
Okay.
And what would that look like?
Okay, if you find yourself in the situation where you don't want to dedicate 10% of your site to retention requirements, which frankly should be a fairly rare circumstance because existing landscaping requirements already commit you to that amount. But in the event that you have to do this, your question is, what am I responsible for as a developer or as a city? What is your...
Let's say a private rather
okay,
than...
Okay, so the private developer submits plans that say I can only commit 5% of my site to retention requirements. We've provided very specific calculation guidance in the attachment E of this document that says, okay, for that remaining 5% that you were not willing to address, we will use the conditions on your site, whether they're desoils, contaminated soils, structurally challenging soils, mm-hmm. or whether they're type A soils that would allow for a lot of infiltration. The site conditions that you actually have on site are going to dictate the volume of stormwater volume that you will need to address off-site.
Okay.
You will then go to the municipality or the approving agency and ask them what is their preferred mechanism for you to meet these requirements off-site. And then they have the option of selecting projects within the right-of-way, using an in-lieu fee program, using a programmatic approach if they've set one up. But they can also just identify a single location whereby they can point to a place where you can achieve the infiltration of that volume that would have been addressed on your site.
If you're actually picking another site, does the other site come with its requirements already, and then these would be in addition to that site?
We don't place any restraint on the type of site you choose. Right. We don't want the cities to be using the mitigation of a site to address some need of their own,
right.
a mitigation of their own.
Okay.
So it has to just be essentially a new infiltration project.
Okay,
but what an example of what many cities do in this situation is they've got a series of road improvements that they're making that really present an opportunity for them to do some roadway treatment, stormwater quality treatment. They'll do bulb outs or curb bulb extensions, something like that. Or they'll do planter designs in a promenade or something. And they'll say, look, we can actually be, as we go through and do this improvement project, we can actually infiltrate additional stormwater that these folks are generating over here.
Okay. And then my other specific question was on some of the timeline issues where you have time after your project gets going to do these mitigations. And, you know, if you're doing a private one, and I'm looking for it really quick, but I'm not finding it. But you have a series of, I think, public and private, you have different timelines. And the private one might have been longer than the public one, maybe, right?
Right.
Okay, good. But let's say, so you do your project on the primary site, and you have this time period on your alternate sites, but something happens, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You can't, the economics fail, the zoning changes, whatever happens. What's the fallback then for that process?
Mm-hmm.
Does it just go back to an in-lieu fee, or?
We've actually included language in the requirements, and I'll give you the page number here in a second. Page 14 of the attachment in its strikeout version addresses some related issues about the location of the proposed offsite. We're trying to provide flexibility there. But number II in this, I'm just trying to highlight it here. A schedule for completion of the project is going to be required in what the city produces or in what the applicant needs to produce.
Right.
But we provided subsequent clarification that I think it's here. The location, sites located outside the watershed may be approved by the water board. Demonstration of implementation of projects will be as effective. A schedule for completion has been constructed. The proposed offsite has been demonstrated to comply. I'm looking for the flexibility we built in. Demonstrated to comply with water quality, the location, the timing. Here it is, number six. Timing and funding requirements for alternative compliance projects. Have you read those, Mr. Jordan, is that what you're referring to, or have you not seen those? Or
that's the ones in down in B.
It's on page 15.
Bottom of page 15.
So it says what you have to do, but it doesn't say, or I didn't see what happens if you can't do it. Because you're making an assumption at the start. You're letting the primary project continue right then. You're allowing a out year's completion for the mitigation. You know, public example would be council's change and they just say, we're not doing that now. Or private would be they run out of money or whatever else might happen. So what is the consequence or fallback in those type of situations in the out years if the mitigation doesn't get done in that time period?
Well, so maybe extend it up to 5 years. So you're saying beyond that?
No, in that 5-year period.
If I can clarify,
yeah, maybe I'm not.
I think what he's asking is what happens when an applicant has demonstrated, you know, on paper that they're going to do this mitigation. However, once they've built the units and they still have 5 years to build this, they then go bankrupt or go out of business and they haven't done it. So what are the consequences for failure to do
right.
So?
We have not written any provisions for that
possibility.
It'll be up to the cities.
Okay.
Yeah, I think the cities are in a position of demonstrating they've tried to address it in some manner that's more or less consistent with the intent of this.
An intent would be they did, and it just didn't work.
The intent is that we're mitigating for these impacts, and if the city, due to circumstances beyond its control, the project went bankrupt, I think they have a good case of saying, look, we don't have an option here.
Okay.
But here's an approach that we might be taking to address the issue. But this doesn't really dictate those terms.
Thanks.
Mr. Johnson?
Okay, still on alternative compliance. And I'm looking at alternative compliance in the approved urban sustainability area. And if I've got it, tell me if I've got this right. So in an approved, a city can designate an area, leave aside for the moment unincorporated areas, but a city can designate an its downtown, let's say, as an urban sustainability area. And I guess that has to be approved by the executive officer. And then alternative compliance doesn't have to demonstrate lack of feasibility. That's their benefit there. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay,
so it saves them some money for analytical
work. Saves them the analytical money. So I'm trying to visualize downtown Salinas because it's a place I know, where there's a lot of lot line to lot line impermeable existing.
Yeah.
And somebody wants to do a high density, low income a development project there. So the way I assume that this would work is, since it's probably not, those are hard projects to pencil out, especially if it's low-income housing. So what this says is they don't have to demonstrate the infeasibility of dedicating 10% of the lot to infiltration. And so then what are they required to do? Are they required to handle off-site what that 10% of their lot could have handled, depending on soil conditions, or are they exempted completely because it was already impermeable?
And this is within a USA?
So within a USA, yeah. let's say it's already lot-lined to lot-line constructed, or impermeable.
Right. That means that the entire project is a redevelopment, it's replacing impervious surface, and in a USA, there's no requirement for retention.
Okay,
and beyond what the site might have retained through some feature it already had in place.
Okay.
So you don't have to go above the existing retention.
So you don't have to go above existing.
Which we would assume to be zero because it's impervious.
Assume to be zero because it's impervious, and they don't have to have alternative compliance.
That's correct.
For that site.
They're off the hook from retention.
Okay.
They still have to treat their stormwater. That's not a that's a universal requirement.
Okay.
And that kicks in at a low, you know, 5,000 square feet. But water quality treatment is not, I mean, there's no permit in the country that's going to be adopted.
What does that treatment then look like?
That looks. That is what you see in performance requirement number two.
Mm-hmm.
It allows for a flow-through type of design based on volume or flow-based treatment standards that have been in place in California for
several years. So it's maybe sedimentation, dropout, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, some fossil filters, some infiltration devices, or rather bioretention devices. We've spec'd out, and this gets at Dr. Wolf's issue with the soil specifications, but we did include a specification for a biotreatment facility, which is identical, with one exception, to what appears in the Phase 2 permit. But that's not required if you don't want to use that particular device. You can use a regular flow-through treatment device.
Okay.
And if for some reason someone says, I can't do anything on this site, you know, I can't treat my stormwater, I can't retain it, I can't do anything, the requirement for treatment is transferable to an off-site.
Okay.
But that is a very unusual circumstance.
Okay, so what you're saying then is in an approved urban sustainability area that's got existing lot line development, if people are trying to do redevelopment there, that the only requirement that this proposed order puts on them is the existing treatment requirement of stormwater coming off their
right.
property.
And the performance requirement number one, which says, you know, if you have the opportunity to move things around and take advantage of runoff reduction measures, do that and select from one small menu of things to, you know, reduce volume, like divert your downspouts to a cistern or vegetated areas. These are fairly small-scale, non-quantitative measures that they can select to do.
Okay,
those are still in place.
Okay, I'm confused because I thought that they – all right. I have to go back and look at that. All right, thank you.
You're welcome. So the thing to know about the USAs, the urban sustainability areas, is that they are not required by these regulations. They are an option provided to the city to help facilitate their what they're all acknowledging is an important objective of theirs is to do infill and redevelopment. And so by establishing urban sustainability areas, they get this significant unburdening of stormwater requirements, as we've just been describing. So first thing is you don't have to do them. So a city that comes up and says, I don't have time to do this, so this is not reasonable, they don't have to. It's just to their advantage if they choose to do it, so they can provide this benefit to these types of redevelopment projects that Mr. Johnson was just describing. I think we already mentioned that within the urban sustainability area, there is no analysis to justify, you know, having to do off-site or not, because there's no off-site requirement. There's no mitigation on the replaced surfaces. And they still, in our view, kind of in contradiction to what we heard from the city of Atascadero, they do provide an incentive for cities to do infill. The idea that you can simply walk away from requirements for stormwater management is really not even on the table anymore because of the advances in our ability to deal with stormwater and because of the regulatory structure that we find ourselves in. People are going to have to do stormwater management. So the fact that we've limited it to such a degree for these areas really does increase the incentive. And we don't see any evidence that cities or developers are making their decisions about whether to pursue these projects based on stormwater requirements. This is something we hear anecdotally, that maybe a project said they were going to walk because of the stormwater requirements. But obviously it hasn't happened here because the stormwater requirements haven't been in place. And there's been no documented real evidence that such impacts occur. The study that we cited in our key issues document and in the staff report and supporting information for this item really points out that there's so many other issues that developers have to address that this is not the one that is going to make or break a project.
Now,
but I don't want to negate the seriousness which these municipalities perceive this to be an issue, and we have made a significant effort to accommodate their overall objective of doing infill.
One of the comments, or several times I heard that cities were afraid that they wouldn't qualify for USA. So what are the requirements that the executive officer needs to approve a USA?
We have left that fairly general. We want to take this opportunity to learn from the cities what characteristics of redevelopment and infill that are of issue to them. But we have defined some basic requirements, and they're up on the screen here, I believe. So the urban sustainability
page number.
I'm sorry, I keep doing
this
that.
This is on page 15.
Thank you, Jessica.
What number is on page 15?
It's, if you're at the yellow, it's under 3, A1, 2, and 3, I believe, is what he's looking
right
at.
Right here.
Thank you.
Yeah. So the permittee may allow regulated projects located in urban sustainability areas to pursue the alternative compliance. The urban sustainability area may only encompass redevelopment in high-density urban centers that are pedestrian-oriented and or transit-oriented development projects intended to promote infill of existing urban areas. I think cities might be wanting to expand that to include everything in the urban limit line, but frankly, we are not prepared to make it that general. The fact is there will be areas that just simply don't qualify for urban sustainability. This is significant relaxation of the standards, and we don't want to apply it in areas where there's not a significant environmental benefit associated with development, and where transit-oriented and pedestrian-oriented and infill-devoted areas have been declared. We're prepared to make that accommodation, but not in places that, you know, every urbanizing, every growing area. So,
next topic.
Let's see. Extension. USA, Barry's comments. Mr. Johnston talked about the retention. Oh, the site conditions versus the rain falling on the site. And I think I've addressed that these requirements don't require you to actually achieve the full retention volume if your site conditions don't allow it. Both the sizing analysis requirements, the event-based approach, which allows for detention and release, and the 10% are significant accommodations to that site condition. The other thing, of course, is the entire project is predicated on an actual analysis of landscape conditions where we assign retention requirements based on what we actually expect the landscape to do in the face of a rain event. So I think Dr. Wolf has some discomfort around this issue of financial infeasibility. We agree that, you know, there is some subjectivity in that. You guys can jump in anytime. I'm getting fatigued here. The financial infeasibility issue certainly is one that you can look at many different ways, and you can argue back and forth. It's not our intent. I think that should be clear from the way this is written. And in our testimony today, is not our intent to penalize a project that has invested significantly in the design of drainage or site layout or infrastructure that will affect how it can control and manage stormwater. So I think we're in a position to look at those rare cases where a project has made some investment in that level and consider that with the municipality, whether there's a partial application of these standards that makes more sense there, that doesn't produce a financial impact.
And I just wanted to add that the financial infeasibility issue would come into play much less frequently now that we've made the first change that we showed you when we came in after lunch, which was to only require
design phase.
The post-construction requirements to apply to a project that's not got discretionary approval for a project design phase. So we really think that that whole financial and feasibility issue has been minimized, and in the case, you know, where in the rare cases where it will be used, we think there's enough information in the language for us to, you know, use it in an effective way.
Dr. Wolf also mentioned the consistency with the state standards. I think you stated that you feel it would be appropriate to harmonize with those standards, and I think I addressed that in describing the Phase 2 permit, that the Phase 2 permit actually envisions people developing watershed-based hydro modification controls, and it's very reasonable to conclude that those analyses that are done in other regions by other municipalities are going to result in 95th percentile stormwater retention in parts of their jurisdictions. This is not, again, a universal requirement. It's only in those parts of their jurisdictions and in our region where that kind of infiltration is an expected process. Regarding the micromanaging of the soil types, I think, pardon me?
I just want to say we have some alternative language to add to address that issue, and maybe Tamara can read it into the record if you think it addresses that issue. Then.
For what? Micromanagement of soil?
Basically to provide an alternative if an applicant has a different soil mixture that they'd like to use. So do you want me to...
Yeah, like, you know, maybe a generic term like appropriate soil amendment.
Yeah, so I just recommending that we...
What page?
So it's under performance requirement number 2.
Here it is.
So on page 4, sorry, run around like this. We're talking about the design of this system, which, again, is not a requirement. It's an option. People can choose to pursue a biofiltration treatment design. The beauty of this design is that it allows for infiltration, but it uses soils and plant material to achieve treatment. And then it allows for an underdrain to drain away anything that doesn't infiltrate. So regarding the actual soil material, do you want to change the language here?
Yeah, so just developed a sentence to add to the end of right there where the cursor is. A regulated project may utilize an alternative planting medium if it demonstrates its planting medium is equal to or more effective at attenuating pollutants than the specified planting medium mixture. Is that okay?
Perfect.
Okay.
You want to type that in? Someone needs to type that in. That's close to the last issue here. Let me grab your projection. Actually, you don't need to project her writing. But. Okay. So that's micromanaging. I think the last question refers to who's responsible for providing information. Information is required in many places throughout this document, or throughout the, you know, potentially in implementing these requirements. Information will need to be provided by the by the project developers, and where that information is of a nature that really requires professional judgment and a professional expertise, we've specified in those locations that a registered engineer or some comparable qualifying individual prepares that. There, where we remain silent on who develops it, we do not believe that it is essential or necessary to specify such requirements. I'd like to look at the specific requirement. The specific area you were talking about was section B6A3, I think, and I'm going to take a quick look at that because maybe we missed something. B6A3. Maybe it's not. Was it in regards to the special circumstances, Dr. Wolf? Do you remember?
Which page, Thomas?
Page 11 has section B6A3, and I believe that's where Dr. Wolf was referring to. permittee may designate areas. I don't know if that was the right place. So. Documentation and approval of special circumstances. I believe that was it. So that would be D, page 12. And it says that the permittee may provide, shall provide reasonable documentation to justify that the regulated project is more appropriately categorized under the special circumstances category. We did not want to require that the cities bring on special expertise necessarily. We think that the special designation for the historic lake and wetlands are actually more based on historical documentation, not on technical feasibility. They're actually based on the historic condition on the site. And so we're prepared to accept documentation presented by the city's best available personnel on that. If I'm not mistaken, I think that is all the issues that we have recorded and that you mentioned.
Okay, a question for you. In the County of San Luis Obispo's letter from Jim Grant, they make a request that urban sustainability areas should include unincorporated county communities.
Right.
What's your response to that request?
I was referring to that earlier when I said that we do not believe that the designation of urban sustainability areas should apply willy-nilly, for better lack of a better word. We want it to apply in areas where there's going to be a clear demonstration of environmental benefit from the projects that are being built in that area. So when you have high-density, transit-oriented, pedestrian-oriented communities, development, those really do serve a broader suite of environmental benefits. And it's in those areas that we recognize a trade-off that might occur where we could relax stormwater benefits and recognize some benefit from these other broader environmental benefits. We do not want to apply that in an area where there simply is not that level of high density or there's not that level of commitment to infill for improving climate action and environmental benefits. So,
but some unincorporated areas have high density.
They might.
Like, wasn't Orcutt used as the example?
They might. We're not saying we can't. What the county is asking for here is a designation now that the urban limit line, I'm sorry, the urban reserve area constitutes an urban sustainability area.
Okay.
And those are two different things.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I had that point marked too. And I'm just wondering if it makes, certainly I agree that we don't want to designate areas willy-nilly, but there certainly are unincorporated areas which, depending on the nature of the proposed development, could very much align with the concept that's being proposed here. So I'm just wondering, because I heard the county's request orally as a little differently, that, and maybe I heard it wrong, that those be that unincorporated urban reserve areas be eligible for designation.
Absolutely.
By my understanding, they would still have to meet the same criteria.
Right.
I think the real question was if they are not in a city limit, are they? And this was confusing to me when we first started talking about this. And I realized that the counties were kind of treated as municipalities for their incorporated
right.
areas.
Yeah.
So I think it might answer the county's concern if we simply specified that that's not restricted to incorporated areas, but they still have to meet those criteria for the executive officer to approve them.
That's our intent. We don't mean to exclude unincorporated areas. If you'd like, we can find a spot to modify the language.
That makes sense. And the other question I have is, it comes up a couple of places. It comes up in the language, and I don't know what page it's on that you had on the board a minute ago when we were talking about soils. I'm seeing it again on page 5, non-retention-based treatment systems. And it refers to treatments shall be sized to treat. And then it says
two times the 85th percentile hourly rainfall intensity, mm-hmm. or the flow of runoff resulting from a rain equal to at least 0.2 inches per hour intensity. It's not clear to me in the simple reading of that if it has to meet the greater of those or the lesser of those. And I think that, I'm just in the interest of clear language here, I think that's an important distinction. I don't know how often that's repeated. I know it showed up at least twice.
Okay, that we do use the word or, and we're using the precise language that has appeared in stormwater permits up and down the state.
Okay, can you explain to me then what, does it have to meet either or, which means the greater of?
No,
which means the lesser of?
No, what it represents is a different ways of calculating the flow-based treatment standard. You can base it on a flow on a rainfall intensity, or you can base it on a 85th percentile volume hourly rainfall intensity. They're both intensity, and you can base it on either.
So that means that in effect it means the lesser of. Is that correct?
No, an engineer will choose the one that they're most accustomed to using, or that maybe they feel fits into their calculations better. It's not based on the more rigorous of the two. They're not meant to distinguish rigor. They're meant to distinguish a method.
The two wouldn't necessarily be equal in terms of the rate, right? So an 85th percentile in one place may not be equal to 0.2 inches, I think is what the board member is getting at. So if I was doing a development and I was the engineer, I'd say, well, let's see. The 85th percentile storm in this area is half an inch a year.
Right.
I'm going to design for 0.2 inches.
That's their prerogative.
Okay. So that gives a prerogative to the city, or it gives a prerogative as they're writing their ordinance, or it gives a prerogative to the developer, whoever's submitting the permit?
The city can change this if they wish. If they put it in as it is, I think that then extends the option to the developer, which I think is the more conventional approach.
Okay.
There are many engineers in the crowd who might be able to correct me on that if I've misconstructed. The other issue about 85th percentile, 95th percentile rainfall statistics that came up when Ms. Huff mentioned that we really can't adopt these because they're incomplete because they don't include those statistics. I just wanted to point out that we've included the methodology for calculating those, and they aren't. The Water Board is not going to be developing information that's not available already. It's just we're trying to make it convenient and provide kind of a consistent basis for that. We plan to provide when we provide those statistics. We also plan to provide a sort of an exception that provides a municipality or developer potentially with the option of choosing their own calculation of the 85th and 95th percentile statistic if they can demonstrate that it's actually more accurate than the one that's being provided by the Water Board. The 85th percentile statistic is available in most of the software that the engineers are currently using. But, you know, again, it's one figure for a fairly large area. And as Dr. Wolf will attest, rainfall varies considerably. And so there's the option for them to actually calculate a different rainfall if they have the data to support that. So to me that wasn't a basis for not adopting these. I wanted to mention that.
Okay. It's in the board's hands at this point. What would the board like to do? Someone want to make a motion, or someone want to propose something, or what?
Your microphone.
We're missing one board member, so maybe we should.
Staff also hasn't made a final recommendation, so
okay.
I think that we should do that, and make a final recommendation.
Okay.
To adopt the resolution with the changes that staff has proposed in response to the comments that you have heard here today.
And the previous errata.
Yes.
Right.
So staff would, if you're prepared for that, I can make
the changes.
So I would recommend, as staff
that the Water Board adopt this resolution with the changes in the two supplemental sheets and the changes that we have developed here in the hearing room on the documents on screen.
I'd like to add one thing, and that is that one of the comments I heard come from the board a few times this morning was that you would be interested in having information brought back to you on how it's going and whether any adjustments are necessary. And I think that staff should do that. We should plan to bring a report back to the board, and we can do that in a year or 2 years or 3 years, whatever seems adequate based on the progress that's being made and any recommendations at that time for making adjustments.
Mr. Johnston.
If possible, I would like to see staff, maybe before they come back to the board, reconvene the joint effort so that what they're coming back to the board with is enlightened by the experience of the various permittees in dealing with these requirements.
I agree, and I meant to include that. It would not be staff in isolation doing this evaluation. It would have to be part of the process that's been ongoing now for 2 years. So we would continue that process.
Okay. Do we want to wait for Russ? I mean, we have...
Yeah.
We do?
Yeah.
Okay. John, do you want to just see if he's on the phone? If he's on the phone, tell him to get off.
Yeah.
If he's not, then we'll have to just wait, because that
be
means he's elsewhere.
The phone or the throne?
Okay.
Take a break?
Well, let's wait. That could take us 10 minutes to get back to where we're at right now. Okay, Mr. Jeffries.
I'm here. Sorry.
Okay. So, Dominic, do you want to go over staff's recommendation so that Mr. Jeffries can hear it?
Certainly. Staff is recommending that the board adopt the resolution with the changes in the supplemental sheets and the changes that we've made to the document here before you today. We are also recommending that you direct staff to come back to the board in a year's time. Year?
A year is fine. I think that's adequate.
Yeah. A year is actually before implementation begins, so we might want to wait a year and a half.
Okay.
Well, but you might want to come back and give a progress report on an annual basis in terms of how this is being implemented.
But if implementation doesn't commence for a year...
But you are going to be working with the municipalities
okay.
in terms of
yeah.
drafting
yeah. and
ordinances
we're going to be developing
and that kind
guidance
of thing.
And so let's say a year... to come back to the board and report on the work that we have undertaken in conjunction with the joint effort review team, which we will reconvene if they are willing. They've already committed a substantial amount of effort to that, but we'll try to reconstitute that a committee and work with them to identify the obstacles to implementation and some of the best ways to overcome and resolve those.
All right. Do we have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I'll make that motion to approve the resolution and incorporate the supplemental pages, the changes talked about today, the staff report back in a year in conjunction with the outreach group. And I think this, you know, this is exactly what should take place in a process like this, the dialogue that's taken place back and forth, the adjustments to meet specific stakeholder and board questions, and I think it's truly a win-win for all sides moving forward.
I second Mr. Jordan's motion and his comments.
Okay. All those in favor of the motion, say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, motion carried unanimously. Thank you very much.
Thank you all.
Thank you, staff. Thank you, stakeholders, for your comments. And to be continued as it unfolds. Let's go on and move through number 9 and 10, and then we'll take a break.
Oh, yeah.